plague. We are in the middle of a plague. 40 million infected people is a plague.
AIDS is now the leading cause of death.
Demonstrators blocked access to buildings.
Coalition of gay groups came to shut down the FDA.
This government has the resources to deal with the AIDS epidemic, and they won't do it unless we force them.
We want everybody to join us. We are trying to arouse to anger and action.
Until we get our acts together, we are as good as dead.
Welcome to Film Wax Radio, the independent film talk show. Every week we're visited by filmmakers, actors, journalists, programmers, and others to sit down and talk about the state of independent film. Director, producer David France is an award-winning journalist and New York Times best-selling author who has been writing about AIDS since 1982. Today he's one of the best-known chroniclers of the epidemic, having continued in the New York Times, where he was AIDS newswriter in the 1990s, Newsweek, where he was senior editor for investigations till 2003, and now GQ and New York Magazine, where he's a contributing editor. Mr. France has received the National Headliner Award and the GLAAD Media Award, and has seen his work inspire several films, most recently the Emmy-nominated Showtime film Our Fathers. He is at work on a new book, A Major History of AIDS, due from Knopf in 2013. How to Survive a Plague is the story of the brave young men and women who successfully reversed the tide of an epidemic, demanded the attention of a fearful nation, and stopped AIDS from becoming a death sentence. Frank Bruni of the New York Times said, "I sat down to watch this film and expected to cry, and cry I did. What I didn't expect was how much hope I would feel and how much comfort. I don't exaggerate when I suggest that How to Survive a Plague should be shown in every school system. It shows what America is truly about, standing up and fighting for basic human rights." The film has received standing ovations at film festivals around the country, including Sundance, New Directors, New Films, San Francisco, and Outfest. This remarkable documentary, so moving and inspirational, will have its New York, LA, Chicago, and San Francisco theatrical debut this Friday, September 21st. I urge you to go see it. Welcome to Film Wax Radio, David France.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Thank you. I said I saw it at New Directors, New Films this past year, and I don't think I remember such an engaged crowd in many, many years. Your crowds so far have been, to say enthusiastic is probably an understatement.
It brings to life the film, a period of time that is... for people who are there, brings them right back to it. And for people who weren't there, gives them a sense of a piece of history that they had no idea about. So people have been responding really in amazing ways.
This is going to sound a little strange, given the subject, but that you almost feel like you missed out if you weren't there. It's that kind of level of unity and passion.
Right.
And thrill. And thrill.
There's a thrill to it. Which is, it's taken us years to be able to say that, because it was such a hideous time, but it was a time of incredible, individual initiative, and, when I was set out to make the film, I was calling that period of like a medical thriller, and that's the film that I set out to make, was this idea that. No one believed it would be possible to survive, and yet these people wrested survival, out of the plague, and it was pretty amazing. It's just amazing. It was amazing to watch at the time, and amazing to re-experience through all that archival footage.
Mm-hmm. Where were you in your life in the early '80s when you first became aware of ACT UP?
I had moved, I had just graduated college in 81, and moved to New York that June. And so I was in the city for 3 weeks before the first published article about this mysterious new disease hit the papers.
Were they referring to it even then as the gay plague, or is it?
It was a gay cancer. They called
it gay cancer.
Yeah.
Well, at least
gay cancer affecting 41 individuals. I watched it go from 41 to 34 million, so it kind of happened on my watch. You know, it's why I became a journalist. The first year or so, I didn't pay much attention to what was happening with the disease. But after that, it became something that I felt a need to do something about. But I didn't know really enough about it. So I started kind of, poking around and asking questions and then trying to disseminate whatever information I found. So I started writing for the gay presses back in the early 80s, which were the only places you could find news about the disease. And then ultimately kept writing about it through the other media that you talked about.
Mm-hmm. What was the... How did you find the initial alternate press?
Well,
one would suspect that they would have been on the ball, but they weren't, were they?
Well, there was one newspaper in New York, the New York Native. There were actually two newspapers that did reporting nationally. One was the Gay Community News in Boston, and that's where I was first writing. And then the New York Native started in New York. It was mm-hmm. published every other week, kind of on the model of the Village Voice from that time.
Mm-hmm.
And they took the epidemic very seriously, and published regularly on it. It became the publication that people at the National Institutes of Health would subscribe to find out what was happening among doctors and the reports that we were bringing in from clinics. You know, the clinician mm-hmm. Eye view of the epidemic was really, were it not for that newspaper, would not have been told.
It's curious because doctors, were they committing to figuring out the cause of AIDS at the time? You don't hear about that medical community.
Those
actually,
pioneering doctors.
No.
Yeah. Well, a lot of them were gay. A lot of those early doctors.
Perhaps experiencing.
And a lot of them died. You know, a lot of mm-hmm. them just didn't make it through the plague. There were, and still are, some really essential and important doctors from those first days. But for the most part, they were community docs. I mean, like one doctor I think about, he's in the film only passingly, is Dr. Joseph Sonnabend, who was, the first person in New York really to start seeing this happen. And he was a gay man mm-hmm. working a very unglamorous practice in the city. He's, he's basically a clap doctor, he sure. did STDs and sexually transmitted diseases among gay men. That's what he did. He's kind of a miserable underside of a medical practice.
Yeah.
But it put him right on the front line, and he's a brilliant doctor. There's a series of kind of personal crises that got him to that point where that's all he was doing. But if it weren't for him, we wouldn't have, that New York Times piece wouldn't have happened. He was bringing this information forward, and he became the one of those early heroes in AIDS medicine.
And what do you think? Could the fight have been what it was without a Larry Kramer?
It would not have been the same. Would it have even happened? I don't know.
Because he was a unifier, but he also ruffled a lot of, even internally, right? At ACT UP, he was also a character of conflict.
He was.
A figure of conflict.
And going way before that, I mean, he wrote a book in the 70s that, I think was his first novel. And it was received with horror mm-hmm. in the community. And it was a condemnation of gay male sexual promiscuity. So when HIV hit, he seemed like the Cassandra.
Yeah.
And was dismissed, in his early writings about the plague as being a person who has finally found a disease that would bolster his, novelistic...
His cause, so to speak. Yeah.
But he didn't stop, and he wrote and wrote and wrote, and... starting very early, he founded with five other gentleman, the Gay Men's Health Crisis, the first AIDS service organization. But even there, he was, you know, he's thrown out because he goes his own direction. And but at, he's a maverick in that way, and that's what's allowed him to play this significant role through history. I think
staying on the margins, staying on the margins intentionally, was his way of in being effective.
I don't know if it's intentional or characterological
or character,
right? So, well, but there always, he is.
Right. I mean, it seems as though, especially as it's represented in your film, that you know, the organization always had some desire ultimately to incorporate the a kind of way of. Being palatable to the mainstream, that being an effective way of getting help and of getting funding and of, you know,
absolutely,
and reaching just more people and more supporters.
Right, and he conflicted with that tendency. I mean, what happened in 87? You know, and he kind of becomes again the pivot. He gives a speech that people go to flock to, and then respond to by immediately calling for an organization, a new organization, a grassroots protest group. Mm-hmm. And that's how ACT UP formed.
I see.
Right? But the people who joined ACT UP began to be representative of the people who are catching HIV, which were people in all walks of life, really. So you start seeing people show up to those early meetings who are, you know, PR pros. Mm-hmm. You know, one guy, Bob Rafsky, who's in the film, he had been representing Donald Trump before becoming ill himself, before going out on disability, before joining ACT UP and taking that same skill set to AIDS activism. Mm-hmm. So he knew how to bring ideas to the media. Other people were working on the cause who were like in advertising. You know, they were selling Coca-Cola during the day and selling AIDS at night,
right,
and making it as grand as, like, you know, Madonna. You know, it was an event. AIDS
absolutely
was made into an event by those people. There are people coming from just Ann Northrup, who's also in the film, had been a news producer for ABC. Mm-hmm. So she knew how to craft messages that could get on the evening news. And you saw them week after week refining the issues of the moment so that they could control the media and the world and the hearts and minds of America, really, the next week. And they pulled it off. They pulled it off brilliantly. They were also created a look, you know, the ACT UP look, which became a kind of this national touchstone of the black leather jacket
the
shirts.
Yes,
and
ubiquitous in the film.
And the boots that the people wore. And and all of that was kind of an intentional marketing concept that was selling AIDS to a country that had been paying no attention to it before. And they pulled it off. Now, Larry was thought the merchandising aspect of ACT UP was
distasteful.
Was not just distasteful, but was going in exactly the wrong direction, that they should be burning buildings, not selling shirts to buildings, to the people in the buildings. And there was that kind of tension, which allowed for a dynamism within the group that I think kept it fresh and alive and looking forward for... Well, the film covers 9 years, so and grassroots organizations typically don't have that kind of, kinetic life for that many years anyway. And you see the thing fall apart. I mean, it fell apart. All movements do. And again, there's, you know, Larry in that breach. And at that moment in the film where the groups are splitting, that's where you see Larry... in his full power,
sure.
Where
he could leverage, whether I'm not suggesting that it was somehow malign in any way, but he was certainly saw the opportunity to have his full voice back.
Right.
You know.
Exactly. Yeah.
So we're speaking with David France, whose new documentary film, feature film, his first, "How to Survive a Plague," is going to be. Enjoying its theatrical run starting Friday, September 21st, in major cities around the country, and hopefully then closer to a smaller city near you. It belongs in, I think, I said earlier the school system, but I was serious. I think it's I assume there's a plan for like an educational distribution as well.
There is, yeah. Or, so it'll be starting early next year.
And who are you working with on that?
We're still developing that part.
I got you.
We want to make sure we get it out to theaters immediately. So right. That's our kind of a main task right now.
And it's had a great amount of success in the festival circuit already. A lot of great response, and
we've enjoyed great reception.
Yeah,
it's been great.
And you see a lot of old friends on the road.
Sometimes. Well, I'm really surprised by how many people who are like young people coming to this film, that it's not being seen as kind of a reminiscence of a long forgotten era. It's being embraced by people like on college campuses, and our largest audiences have been in places like Columbia, Missouri. We filled a 1,700 seat theater in Columbia, Missouri, at 10 o'clock on a Sunday morning.
Really?
It was that's just amazing, insane, story. And the response. I mean,
have any conjecture about that?
About why?
Why it's connecting?
I think people need, want, and are hungry for stories about heroes, especially young heroes. I mean, one of the things that's changed in the 30 years since this story took place is that young people, college age people the age of the activists in this film, feel even more powerless today than people felt then. And to see an example of youthful empowerment is thrilling to people, and they do want to join. They do want to take part. They're kind of jealous about it. And so when you open up the microphones, people, the first comments are, "How can I help? What can I do? How can I join this? Mm-hmm. How can I grab that kind of power and influence and right. authority?"
It's a very appealing. Yeah. As we said at the beginning, like of our conversation, there is a hunger for the unifying and something to important bigger than ourselves
right.
to grab hold of and actually to do some good,
yeah.
as opposed to so much of our culture, which is so disposable.
Yeah,
not necessarily bad, but right. disposable.
Right, but lasting good. You're
lasting
right.
good.
See, and that makes it revolutionary.
I started to look for treatments to help save our life.
I wish they'd shut their mouths and get their mentality out of their crotches.
There was nothing coming out of our government's efforts.
But no, they march in the streets. They defy you.
I decided to become a full-time AIDS activist.
They all had to become scientists to some degree.
We can take a drug, your test tube, to the market in under 2 years. This total reluctance on your part is going to get you nowhere. It'll end up killing us.
The death rate just kept on climbing.
It became very clear that you weren't going to mess with these people.
I am going to fight them. My patients are going to fight them. And you're goddamn welcome.
We need our government to save our lives.
This isn't going to be cured for years and years and years.
You've got to be asked this every time, every Q&A, every interview, but it's there must have been a remarkable amount of footage to go through, and it seems like a lot of people somehow knew to film these meetings and the protests.
Yeah.
And then, of course, there's news footage as well, of course.
There is some, yeah. Well, I remembered that mm-hmm. there were cameras everywhere during
you
all
did.
Of this.
Yeah.
And what I didn't know until I started asking myself why all these cameras were there was that the camcorder was introduced in early
1982. Early 80s. Right.
So it becomes kind of a parallel pandemic, really.
Yeah.
These cameras everywhere, and the people who joined together in 87 to form this ACT UP and AIDS activism
mm-hmm.
were people who were very kind of connected to the arts, connected
yes.
to the idea that connected to the media, the idea that nobody was paying any attention to AIDS. Nobody was paying attention to AIDS activism or agency within the, you know, within the epidemic. The evening news would only shoot patients in bed. They repeated and repeated those stories of AIDS victimhood, and so what was happening within the community of activists and artists was that they started gathering their own stories, because they knew that the story was much more complicated than the hospital bed. It may have included the hospital bed, but it also included all this other stuff, and they started to do it at first as a kind of like a newsreel to show to one another.
Yes,
like here we did this last week. Public access TV cable became available just about that time, and they were signing up for their free hour or whatever you were getting on public access, and they were putting this up like the last week's demonstrations. You could see it on channel 137
like
or something. Right, exactly. Yeah. And then they started selling some of the footage to, you know, the mainstream media, because they had access. They were there. They would just, you know, they had that stuff. Mm-hmm. So I knew that there were all these cameras. So the question was, for me, could I gather up enough footage from multiple sources to be able to tell this really small, intimate story of a couple of people inside this epic, you know, period? Could I tell that story through these people over that 9-year period and keep the audience with me
engaged? Yeah.
And that was, it was hard work trying to find enough of that footage to do that.
But
and
Peter Steele emerged as right. But Steele emerged as one of the
right
people.
And I knew that that was likely to be the case because he was, you know, people had kind of their expertise within the movement. And his expertise was being kind of young, good-looking boy next door with AIDS.
Right.
So he presented himself to the media regularly, and he was regularly chronicled. So I knew that I knew that there was probably enough footage from Peter that it would be able to carry his narrative through. And there were some other people whose stories I wanted to tell, but I just couldn't find the footage for. So. It was a balancing act, you know. When you try to do something like this, you're not really, it's not a pure historian's job, because it's really only the material that I was able to cobble together.
Well, it was certainly a remarkable film, and it works on every level. It kind of as a document of the time, as you know, as just a great it's an entertaining film. Highly, highly entertaining and also poignant. So it's
funny, right? I mean, there's a lot of humor.
Oh, there is. Yeah. You know, that comes out of some great characters with some trying some really crazy, goofy ideas.
Yeah.
And you know,
some of them working,
some of them not.
Right.
I remember people on roofs a lot.
Yeah. There's a lot of climbing up.
Yeah.
For some reason.
There's,
yeah. And when I started this, I kept saying to people that I was making an uplifting AIDS film. And, you know, people would raise their eyebrows and go, what? What?
Well, they have to see it to understand. And they'll have their opportunity on September 21st. Do you know what theater it's going to be here in New York?
IFC Center.
The IFC Center.
In New York.
That's good. I was going to, wanted to give some much deserved credit to some of the other crew that you have assembled for this film, because it's so much of it is in the editing. So we should mention your editor is T. Woody Richman and Tyler H. Walk.
Mm-hmm.
And how did you come to meet your editors or find them?
I had known Tyler when I first began thinking about the project. I was introduced to Tyler as a person who could digitize some tapes for me. I knew that he had studied editing and had some ambition in that area. But the editor that I hired was Woody.
I see.
Whose work I knew and admired. I mean, he comes out of the Michael Moore universe,
right?
But he edited
Trouble
in Water.
Does that mean commercial documentary, or just sort of?
Tell me what you mean by that.
I don't know. Like you say, a Michael Moore documentary. In this case, capitalism, right?
Right.
But you know, it's where it's
he. What I wanted from my editor, was somebody who could handle a ton of material.
I see.
And he also did Trouble the Water, which is a film unlike the Michael Moore films.
Very true.
It's a beautiful film about Hurricane Katrina.
Tia Lesson and Carl Diehl's film.
Exactly.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites, yeah.
It's one of my favorites, too. And it's because it tells... What I love about that film and what I wanted to replicate in How to Survive a Plague was to tell a tiny, tiny, tiny story of a couple of people in this epic universe, right? This huge universe. Mm. And have their stories speak to, in that case, race in America and class and politics. And in this case, you know, very similar themes.
And one other theme that is very similar, which we touched on, which was that, you know, Kimberly in the Trouble of the Water, not a victim.
Correct, right.
And you know, exactly. To show that...
Yeah. And there's
victims of circumstances, and then there's, you know, people that rise above them.
Exactly. And she was heroic.
She was
heroic.
And look at her story, just as far as her transition.
Yeah.
It's a beautiful story.
Right. You see her find her heroic voice. And the story is told with such generosity. And that's what I kept saying to Woody when I would leave him messages saying, you've got to call me back. and he just was not eager to sign on with a first-time filmmaker. And I finally trapped him into it.
Good.
And then we brought Tyler on to be an editor with Woody. So we knew we were overwhelmed. We knew we needed a second cutting room. And Tyler just turned out to have such, you know, brilliant editing skills that really complemented Woody's. So I shuttled back and forth between two rooms for about a year.
And how long was the process of making the film?
We were about 14 months in the cutting room. And it was about 3 years altogether. And I was still bringing in footage, you know, as we were on the way to the airport for Sundance, driving these poor editors nuts. I couldn't stop. I mean, we just kept finding, you know, better and better camera angles.
So
we kept going back to recut.
Yeah.
But yeah, we were 14 months trying to discover the story. And when we first put put everything together, we kind of divided up the scenes that we wanted to tell, sent the editors off to their corners, mm-hmm. And assembled it in chronological order over this 9-year period. And we came up with a film that was 13 hours long. And it showed us what parts of the story we could really nail from this archival footage. And what parts we'd have to reach further for,
mm-hmm.
And it also taught us a lot about the individuals in their trajectories, and we kind of studied that 13-hour cut to try to figure out where the 2-hour movie was in there.
Interesting. You probably don't see that too often, that approach, but it must have been incredible
because it's not time. It may be impractical on some level.
An efficient way to do something like this. Unless you're showing it as an HBO 13-hour.
Right. Exactly. The Shoah of AIDS.
Yeah. thank you very much. I recommend and urge again everyone to go see How to Survive a Plague, and if you don't live in a city where it's going to be playing, I'm sure it'll be available. On demand and all that.
It'll be on demand
eventually,
yeah.
But go see it in the theater and tell your friends all about it. David France, thanks so much for coming on FilmWax Radio.
Thank you. This has been really fun.
I thought so too. Thank you very much.
Someday there will be a people alive on this earth who will hear the story that once there was a terrible disease, and that a brave group of people stood up and fought, and in some cases died, so that others might live and be free.
I was feeling kind of hungry, so I thought I'd buy some bread. I went into the corner grocery store. I took out the usual money, but the grocer shook his head, 'cause a dollar ain't a dollar anymore. Oh, a dollar bill don't buy what it used to, don't buy what it used to, don't buy what it used to. A dollar bill don't.